but... She dropped the phone back into its cradle. A queer, disheartening certainty came to her. It was a woman. Some woman had called him, and he had gone to her. Well, what now, Audra? How do we handle this? She felt tears threaten. They stung her eyes and her nose. She could feel the lump of a sob in the back of her throat. No anger, at least not yet, only a sick sense of loss and abandonment. Audra, get hold of yourself. You're jumping to conclusions. It's the middle of the night and you had a bad dream and now you've got Bill with some other woman. But it ain't necessarily so. What you're going to do is sit up. You'll never get back to sleep now anyway. Turn on some lights and finish the novel you brought to read on the plane. Remember what Bill says? Finest kind of dope. Book volume. No more heebie-jeebies, no more whim-whams and hearing voices. Dorothy Sayers and Lord Peter, that's the ticket. The Nine Tailors. That'll take you through to dawn. That'll... The bathroom light suddenly went on. She could see it under the door. Then the latch clicked and the door juddered open. She stared at this, eyes widening, arms instinctively crossing over her breasts again. Her heart began to slam against her rib cage, and the sour taste of adrenaline flooded her mouth. That voice, low and dragging, said, "We all float down here, Audra." The last word became a long, low, fading scream. "Audra!" That ended once again in that sick, clogged, bubbly sound that was so much like laughter. "Who's there?" she cried, backing away. "That wasn't my imagination. No way. You're not going to tell me that." The TV clicked on. She whirled around and saw a clown in a silvery suit with big orange buttons capering around on the screen. There were black sockets where its eyes should have been, and when its made-up lips stretched even wider in a grin, she saw teeth like razors. It held up a dripping, severed head. Its eyes were turned up to the whites, and the mouth sagged open, but she could see well enough that it was Freddy Firestone's head. The clown laughed and danced. It swung the head around, and drops of blood splashed against the inside of the TV screen. She could hear them sizzling in there. Audra tried to scream, and nothing came out but a little whine. She grabbed blindly for the dress lying over the back of the chair and for her purse. She bolted into the hall and slammed the door behind her, gasping, her face paper white. She dropped the purse between her feet and slipped the dress over her head. "Float," a low, chuckling voice said from behind her, and she felt a cold finger caress her bare heel. She uttered another high, out-of-breath scream and danced away from the door. White corpse fingers were seeking back and forth under it, the nails peeled away to show purplish, white, bloodless quicks. They made hoarse whispering noises on the rough nap of the hall carpet. Audra snagged the strap of her purse and ran barefooted for the door at the end of the corridor. She was in a blind panic now, her only thought that she had to find the Derry townhouse and Bill. It didn't matter if he was in bed with enough other women to make up a harem. She would find him and get him to take her away from whatever unspeakable thing there was in this town. She fled down the walkway and into the parking lot, looking around wildly for her car. For a moment, her mind froze, and she couldn't even remember what she had been driving. Then it came. Datsun, tobacco brown. She spotted it standing hubcap deep in the still, curdled ground mist and hurried over to it. She couldn't find the keys in her purse. She swept through it with steadily increasing panic, shuffling Kleenex, cosmetics, change, sunglasses, and sticks of gum into a meaningless jumble. She didn't notice the battered LTD wagon parked nose-to-nose with her rented car, or the man sitting behind the wheel. She didn't notice when the LTD's door opened and the man got out. She was trying to cope with the growing certainty that she had left the Datsun's keys in the room. She couldn't go back in there. She couldn't. Her fingers touched hard serrated metal under a box of Altoid mints, and she seized at it with a little cry of triumph. For a terrible moment, she thought it might be the key to their rover, now sitting in the Fleet Railway Station's car park 3,000 miles away, and then she felt the Lucite rental car tab. She fumbled the key into the door lock, breathing in harsh little gasps, and turned it. That was when a hand fell on her shoulder and she screamed, screamed loudly this time. Somewhere a dog barked in answer, but that was all. The hand, as hard as steel, bit cruelly in and forced her around. The face she saw looming over hers was puffed and lumpy. The eyes glittered. When the swelled lips spread in a grotesque smile, she saw that some of the man's front teeth had been broken. The stumps looked jagged and savage. She tried to speak and could not. The hand squeezed tighter, digging in.
"Haven't I seen you in the movies?" Tom Rogan whispered.
3. Eddie's room. Beverly and Bill dressed quickly without speaking and went up to Eddie's room. On their way to the elevator, they heard a phone bell begin somewhere behind them. It was muffled, a somewhere else sound. Bill, was that yours?
Could have been, he said. One of the others calling, maybe.
He punched the up button. Eddie opened the door for them, his face white and strained. His left arm was at an angle both peculiar and weirdly evocative of old times.
I'm okay, he said. I took 2 Darvon.
Pain's not bad right now, but it was clearly not good either. His lips, pressed so tightly together they had almost disappeared, were purple with shock. Bill looked past him and saw the body on the floor. One look was enough to satisfy him of 2 things. It was Henry Bowers, and he was dead. He moved past Eddie and knelt by the body. The neck of a Perrier bottle had been driven into Henry's midsection, pulling the tatters of his shirt in after it. Henry's eyes were half open, glazed. His mouth, filled with coagulating blood, snarled. His hands were claws. A shadow fell over him and Bill looked up. It was Beverly. She looked down at Henry with no expression at all.
All the times he chased us, Bill said.
She nodded.
He doesn't look old. You know that, Bill? He doesn't look old at all.
Abruptly, she looked back at Eddie, who was sitting on the bed. Eddie looked old, old and haggard. His arm lay in his lap, useless.
We've got to call the doctor for Eddie.
No, Bill and Eddie said in unison.
But he's hurt, his arm.
It's the same as the last time, Bill said. He got to his feet and held her by the arms, looking into her face.
Once we go outside, once will we in the hall the town, they'll arrest me for murder,
Eddie said dully. Or they'll arrest all of us, or they'll detain us or something. Then there'll be an accident, one of the special accidents that only happen in Derry. Maybe they'll stick us in jail and a deputy sheriff will go berserk and shoot us all. Maybe we'll all die of ptomaine or decide to hang ourselves in our cells.
Eddie, that's crazy. That's...
Is it? He asked.
Remember, this is Derry.
But we're grown-ups now. Surely you don't think... I mean, he came here in the middle of the night, attacked you.
Well, with what?
Bill said.
Where's the knife?
She looked around, didn't see it, and dropped on her knees to look under the bed.
Don't bother,
Eddie said in that same faint, whistly voice.
I slammed the door on his arm when he tried to stick me with it. He dropped it, and I kicked it under the TV. It's gone now. I already looked.
Beverly, could call the others, Bill said.
I can splint Eddie's arm, I think.
She looked at him for a long moment, then she looked down at the body on the floor again. She thought that the picture this room presented should tell a perfectly clear story to any policeman with half a brain. The place was a mess. Eddie's arm was broken. This man was dead. It was a clear case of self-defense against a night prowler. And then she remembered Mr. Ross. Mr. Ross getting up and looking, and then simply folding his newspaper and going back into the house.
Once we go outside, once we involve the town.
That made her remember Bill as a kid, his face white and tired and half crazy. Bill saying,
Derry is it. Do you understand me? Any place we go, when it gets us, they won't see, they won't hear, they won't know. Don't you see how it is? All we can do is try and finish what we started.
Standing here now, looking down at Henry's corpse, Beverly thought,
they're both saying we've all become ghosts again, that it started to repeat, all of it. As a kid, I could accept that, because kids almost are ghosts. But,
are you sure? She asked desperately. Bill, are you sure? He was sitting on the bed with Eddie, gently touching his arm.
Aren't you you?
He asked. After all that's happened today?
Yes, all that had happened.
The gruesome mess at the end of their reunion. The beautiful old woman who had turned into a crone before her eyes.
My father was also my mother.
The round of stories at the library tonight with the accompanying phenomena. All of those things. And still, her mind shouted at her desperately to stop this now, to spike it with sanity, because if she did not, they were surely going to finish up this night by going down to the Barrens and finding a certain pumping station and...
I don't know, she said. I don't know.
Even after everything that's happened, Bill, it seems to me that we could call the police, maybe.
Call the others, he said again. We'll see what they think.
All right. She called Richie first, then Ben. Both agreed to come right away. Neither asked what had happened. She found Mike's telephone number in the book and dialed it. There was no answer. After a dozen rings, she hung up. To try the Lala library, Bill said. He had taken the short curtain rods down from the smaller of the two windows in Eddie's room and was binding them firmly to Eddie's arm with the belt of his bathrobe and the drawstring from his pajamas. Before she could find the number, there was a knock at the door. Ben and Richie had arrived together. Ben, in jeans and an untucked shirt, Richie in a pair of smart gray cotton trousers and his pajama top. His eyes looked warily around the room from behind his glasses. Christ, Daddy, what happened to... Oh, my God, Ben cried. He had seen Henry on the floor. Bubba be quiet, Bill said sharply, and close the door. Richie did it, his eyes fixed on the body. Henry? Ben took three steps toward the corpse and then stopped, as if afraid it might bite him. He looked helplessly at Bill. You to tell, he said to Eddie. Goddamn stutter is getting worse all the time. Eddie sketched in what had happened while Beverly hunted up the number for the Derry Public Library and called it. She expected that perhaps Mike had fallen asleep there. He might even have a bunk in his office. What she did not expect was what happened. The phone was picked up on the second ring, and a voice she had never heard before said hello. Hello, she answered, looking toward the others and making a shushing gesture with one hand. Is Mr. Hanlon there? Who's this? The voice asked. She wet her lips with her tongue. Bill was looking at her piercingly. Ben and Richie had looked around. The beginnings of real alarm stirred inside her. Who are you? She countered. You're not Mr. Hanlon. I'm Derry Chief of Police Andrew Rademacher, the voice said. Mr. Hanlon is at the Derry Home Hospital right now. He was assaulted and badly wounded a short time ago. Now, who are you, please? I want your name. But she barely heard this last. Waves of shock rode through her, lifting her dizzily up and up, outside of herself. The muscles in her stomach and legs and crotch all went loose and numb, and she thought in a detached way, this must be how it happens, when people get so scared they wet their pants. Sure, you just lose control of those muscles. How badly has he been hurt? She heard herself asking in a papery voice, and then Bill was beside her, his hand on her shoulder, and Ben was there, and Richie, and she felt such a rush of gratitude for them. She held her free hand out, and Bill took it. Richie placed his hand over Bill's, and Ben put his over Richie's. Eddie had come over, and now he put his good hand on top. I want your name, please, Rademacher said briskly, and for a moment the skittering little craven inside of her, the one that had been bred by her father and cared for by her husband, almost answered, I'm Beverly Marsh, and I'm at the Derry Townhouse. Please send Mr. Nell over. There's a dead man here who's still half a boy, and we're all very frightened. She said, I'm afraid I can't tell you, not just yet. What do you know about this? Nothing, she said, shocked. What makes you think I do? Jesus Christ. You just make a habit of calling the library every morning about 3:30, Rademacher said. Is that it? Can the bullshit, young lady. This is assault, and the way the guy looks, it could be murder by the time the sun comes up. I'll ask you again. Who are you, and how much do you know about this? Closing her eyes, gripping Bill's hand with all her strength, she asked again, He might die? You're not just saying that to scare me. He really might die? Please tell me. He's very badly hurt, and if that doesn't scare you, miss, it ought to. Now, I want to know who you are and why. As if in a dream, she watched her hand float through space and drop the phone back into the cradle. She looked over at Henry and felt shock as keen as a slap from a cold hand. One of Henry's eyes had closed. The other one, the shattered one, oozed as nakedly as before. Henry seemed to be winking at her. 4. Richie called the hospital. Bill led Beverly over to the bed, where she sat with Eddie, looking off into space. She thought she would cry, but no tears came. The only feeling she was strongly and immediately aware of was a wish that someone would cover Henry Bowers. That winky look was really not cool at all. In one giddy instant, Richie became a reporter from the Derry News. He understood that Mr. Michael Hanlon, the town's head librarian, had been assaulted while working late. Did the hospital have any word on Mr. Hanlon's condition? Richie listened, nodding. I understand, Mr. Kerpaskian. Do you spell that with two K's? You do. Okay. And you are? He listened, now enough into his own fiction to make doodling motions with one finger as if writing on a pad. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yes, I understand. Well, what we usually do in cases like this is to quote you as a source. Then later on, we can... Uh-huh, right, just right. Richie laughed heartily and armed a film of sweat from his forehead. He listened again. Okay, Mr. Kerpaskian. Yes, I'll... Yes, I got it. K-E-R-P-A-S-K-I-A-N. Right. Czech Jewish, is it? Really? That's most unusual. Yes, I will. Good night. Thank you. He hung up and closed his eyes. Jesus, he cried in a thick, low voice. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. He made as if to shove the phone off the table and then simply let his hand fall. He took his glasses off and wiped them on his pajama top. He's alive, but in grave condition, he told the others. Henry sliced him up like a Christmas turkey. One of the cuts chopped into his femoral artery, and he's lost all the blood a man can and still stay alive. Mike managed to get some kind of tourniquet on it, or he would have been dead when they found him. Beverly began to cry. She did it like a child, with both hands plastered to her face. For a little while, her hitching sobs and the rapid whistle of Eddie's breathing were the only sounds in the room. Mike wasn't the only one who got sliced up like a Christmas turkey, Eddie said at last. Henry looked like he just went 12 rounds with Rocky Balboa in a Cuisinart. Do you still want to go to the police, Bev? There were Kleenex on the night table, but they were a caked and sodden mass in the middle of a puddle of Perrier. She went into the bathroom, making a wide circle around Henry, got a washcloth and ran cool water on it. It felt delicious against her hot, puffy face. She felt that she could think clearly again, not rationally, but clearly. She was suddenly aware that rationality would kill them if they tried to use it now. That cop, Rademacher, he had been suspicious. Why not? People didn't call the library at 3:30 in the morning. He had assumed some guilty knowledge. What would he assume if he found out that she had called him from a room where there was a dead man on the floor with a jagged bottleneck planted in his guts? That she and four other strangers had just come into town the day before for a little reunion, and this guy just happened to drop by? Would she buy the tale if the shoe were on the other foot? Would anyone? Of course, they could buttress their tale by adding that they had come back to finish the monster that lived in the drains under the city. That would certainly add a convincing note of gritty realism. She came out of the bathroom and looked at Bill. No, she said. I don't want to go to the police. I think Eddie's right. Something might happen to us. Something final. But that isn't the real reason. She looked at the four of them. We swore it, she said. We swore. Bill's brother, Stan, all the others, and now Mike. I'm ready, Bill. Bill looked at the others. Richie nodded. Okay, Big Bill, let's try. Ben said, the odds look worse than ever. We're too short now. Bill said nothing. Okay, Ben nodded. She's right. We swore. Eddie? Eddie smiled wanly. I guess I get another pigger back down that ladder, huh? If the ladder's still there. No one throwing rocks this time, though, Beverly said. They're dead, all three of them. Do we do it now, Bill? Richie asked. Yes, Bill said. I think this is the time. Can I say something? Ben asked abruptly. Bill looked at him and grinned a little. Any time. You guys are still the best friends I ever had, Ben said. No matter how this turns out, I just, you know, wanted to tell you that. He looked around at them, and they looked solemnly back at him. I'm glad I remembered you, he added. Richie snorted, Beverly giggled. Then they were all laughing, looking at each other in the old way, in spite of the fact that Mike was in the hospital, perhaps dying, or already dead, in spite of the fact that Eddie's arm was broken, again, in spite of the fact that it was the deepest ditch of the morning. Haystack, you have such a way with words, Richie said, laughing and wiping his eyes. He should have been the writer, Big Bill. Still smiling a little, Bill said, and on that note... 5. They took Eddie's borrowed limo. Richie drove. The ground fog was thicker now, drifting through the streets like cigarette smoke, not quite reaching the hooded street lamps. The stars overhead were bright chips of ice, spring stars. But by cocking his head to the half-open window on the passenger side, Bill thought he could hear summer thunder in the distance. Rain was being ordered up somewhere over the horizon. Richie turned on the radio, and there was Gene Vincent singing Bebopalula. He hit one of the other buttons and got Buddy Holly, A third punch brought Eddie Cochran singing Summertime Blues. "I'd like to help you, son, but you're too young to vote," a deep voice said.
"Turn it off, Richie," Beverly said softly.
He reached for it, and then his hand froze.
"Stay tuned for more of the Richie Tozier All Dead Rock Show,"
the clown's laughing, screaming voice cried over the finger pops and guitar chops of the Eddie Cochran tune.
"Don't touch that dial. Keep it tuned to the rock pile. They're gone from the charts, but not from our hearts, and you keep coming. Come right along. Come on, everybody. We play all the hits down here. All the hits. And if you don't believe me, just listen to this morning's Graveyard Shift guest DJ, Georgie Denbro. Tell him, Georgie."
And suddenly Bill's brother was wailing out of the radio.
"You sent me out and it killed me. I thought it was in the cellar, Big Bill. I thought it was in the cellar, but it was in the drain. It was in the drain and it killed me. You let it kill me, Big Bill. You let it."
Richie snapped the radio off so hard the knob spun away and hit the floor mat. "Rock and roll in the sticks really sucks," he said. His voice was not quite steady. "Bev's right. We'll leave it off. What do you say?" No one replied. Bill's face was pale and still and thoughtful under the glow of the passing street lamps, and when the thunder muttered again in the west, they all heard it. 6. In the Barrens. Same old bridge. Richie parked beside it, and they got out and moved to the railing. Same old railing, and looked down. Same old barrens. It seemed untouched by the last 27 years. To Bill, the turnpike overpass, which was the only new feature, looked unreal, something as ephemeral as a matte painting or a rear screen projection effect in a movie. Cruddy little trees and scrub bushes glimmered in the twining fog, and Bill thought, "I guess this is what we mean when we talk about the persistence of memory. This or something like this, something you see at the right time and from the right angle, image that kicks off emotion like a jet engine. You see it so clear that all the things which happened in between are gone. If desire is what closes the circle between world and want, then the circle has closed." "Cucka, come on," he said, and climbed over the railing. They followed him down the embankment in a scatter of scree and pebbles. When they reached the bottom, Bill checked automatically for silver and then laughed at himself. Silver was leaning against the wall of Mike's garage. It seemed Silver had no part to play in this at all, although that was strange after the way it had turned up. "To take us there," Bill told Ben. Ben looked at him, and Bill read the thought in his eyes. "It's been 27 years, Bill. Dream on." And then he nodded and headed into the undergrowth. The path, their path, had long since grown over, and they had to force themselves through tangles of thorn bushes, prickers, and wild hydrangea so fragrant it was cloying. Crickets sang somnolently all around them, and a few lightning bugs, early arrivals at summer's luscious party, poked at the dark. Bill supposed kids still played down here, but they had made their own runs in secret ways. They came to the clearing where the clubhouse had been, but now there was no clearing here at all. Bushes and lackluster scrub pines had reclaimed it all.
"Look,"
Ben whispered, and crossed the clearing. In their memories, it was still here, simply overlaid with another of those matte paintings. He yanked at something. It was the mahogany door they had found on the edge of the dump, the one they had used to finish off the clubhouse roof. It had been cast aside here and looked as if it hadn't been touched in a dozen years or more. Creepers were firmly entrenched across its dirty surface.
"Leave it alone, Haystack," Richie murmured. "It's old."
"To take us the there, Ben," Bill repeated from behind them.
So they went down to the Kanduskeag, following him, bearing left away from the clearing that didn't exist anymore. The sound of running water grew steadily louder, but they still almost fell into the Kanduskeag before any of them saw it. The foliage had grown up in a tangled wall on the edge of the embankment. The edge broke off under the heels of Ben's cowboy boots, and Bill yanked him back by the scruff of the neck.
"Thanks," Ben said. "De nada. In the old days, you would have pulled me in after you.
Down this way?"
Ben nodded and led them along the overgrown bank, fighting through the tangles of bushes and brambles, thinking how much easier this was when you were only 4'5" and able to go under most tangles.
Those in your mind as well as those in your path, he supposed,
in one nonchalant duck. Well, everything changed. Our lesson for today, boys and girls, is the more things change, the more things change. Whoever said the more things change, the more things stay the same was obviously suffering severe mental retardation because his foot hooked under something and he fell over with a thud, nearly striking his head on the pumping station's concrete cylinder. It was almost completely buried in a wallow of blackberry bushes. As he got to his feet again, he realized that his face and arms and hands had been striped by blackberry thorns in 24 places. "Make that 36," he said, feeling thin blood running down his cheeks. "What?" Eddie asked. "Nothing." He bent down to see what he had tripped over. A root, probably. But it wasn't a root. It was the iron manhole cover. Someone had pushed it off. "Of course," Ben thought. "We did, 27 years ago." But he realized that was crazy even before he saw fresh metal twinkling through the rust and parallel scrape marks. The pump hadn't been working that day. Sooner or later, someone would have come down to fix it and would have replaced the cover in the bargain. He stood up and the five of them gathered around the cylinder and looked in. They could hear the faint sound of dripping water. That was all. Richie had brought all the matches from Eddie's room. Now he lit an entire book of them and tossed it in. For a moment they could see the cylinder's damp inner sleeve and the silent bulk of the pumping machinery. That was all. "Could have been off for a long time," Richie said uneasily. "Didn't necessarily have to happen to..." "It's happened fairly recently," Ben said. "Since the last rain, anyway." He took another book of matches from Richie, lit one, and pointed out the fresh scratches. "There's something under it," Bill said, as Ben shook out the match. "What?" Ben asked. Couldn't tell. Looked like a strap. "You and Richie helped me to turn it over." They grabbed the cover and flipped it like a giant coin. This time, Beverly lit the match, and Ben cautiously picked up the purse which had been under the manhole cover. He held it up by the strap. Beverly started to shake out the match and then looked at Bill's face. She froze until the flame touched the ends of her fingers and then dropped it with a little gasp. "Bill? What is it? What's wrong?" Bill's eyes felt too heavy. They couldn't leave that scuffed leather bag with its long leather strap. Suddenly, he could remember the name of the song which had been playing on the radio in the back room of the leather goods shop when he had bought it for her. "Sausalito Summer Nights." It was the surpassing weirdism. All the spit was gone out of his mouth, leaving his tongue and inner cheeks as smooth and dry as chrome. He could hear the crickets and see the lightning bugs and smell big green dark growing out of control all around him, and he thought, "It's another trick, another illusion. She's in England, and this is just a cheap shot because it's scared. Oh, yes, it's maybe not as sure as it was when it called us all back. And really, Bill, get serious. How many scuffed leather purses with long straps do you think there are in the world? 1 million? 10 million? Probably more, but only one like this. He had bought it for Audra in a Burbank leather goods store while Sausalito Summer Nights played on the radio in the back room. "Bill?" Beverly's hand on his shoulder, shaking him. "Far away, 27 leagues under the sea." What was the name of the group that sang Sausalito Summer Nights? Richie would know. "I know," Bill said calmly into Richie's scared, wide-eyed face and smiled. "It was Diesel. How's that for total recall?" "Bill, what's wrong?" Richie whispered. Bill screamed. He snatched the matches out of and then yanked the purse away from Ben. "Bill, Jesus, what?" He unzipped the purse and turned it over. What fell out was so much Audra that for a moment he was too unmanned to scream again. Amid the Kleenex, sticks of chewing gum, and items of makeup, he saw a tin of Altoid mints and the jewel compact Freddie Firestone had given her when she signed for Attic Room. "My wife's down there," he said, and fell on his knees and began pushing her things back into the purse. He brushed hair that no longer existed out of his eyes without even thinking about it. "Your wife? Audra?" Beverly's face was shocked, her eyes huge. "Her purse. Hurt the things." "Jesus, Bill," Richie muttered. "That can't be. You know the..." He had found her alligator wallet. He opened it and held it up. Richie lit another match and was looking at a face he had seen in 6 movies. The picture on Audra's California driver's license was less glamorous but completely conclusive.
But Henry's dead, and Victor and Belch. So who's got her?
He stood up, staring around at them with febrile intensity.
Who's got her?
Ben put a hand on Bill's shoulder.
I guess we better go down and find out, huh?
Bill looked around at him, as if unsure who Ben might be, and then his eyes cleared.
Yeah, he said. Eddie?
Bill, I'm sorry.
Can you climb on?
I did once.
Bill bent over, and Eddie hooked his right arm around Bill's neck. Ben and Richie boosted him up until he could hook his legs around Bill's midsection. As Bill swung one leg clumsily over the lip of the cylinder, Ben saw that Eddie's eyes were tightly shut. And for a moment, he thought he heard the world's ugliest cavalry charge bashing its way through the bushes. He turned, expecting to see the three of them come out of the fog in the brambles. But all he had heard was the rising breeze rattling the bamboo a quarter of a mile or so from here. Their old enemies were all gone now. Bill gripped the rough concrete lip of the cylinder and felt his way down step by step and rung by rung. Eddie had him in a death grip and Bill could barely breathe.
Her purse, dear God, how did her purse get here?
Doesn't matter.
But if you're there, God, and if you're taking requests, let her be all right. Don't let her suffer for what Bev and I did tonight, or for what I did one summer when I was a boy. And was it the clown? Was it Bob Gray who got her? If it was, I don't know if even God can help her.
I'm scared, Bill,
Eddie said in a thin voice. Bill's foot touched cold, standing water. He lowered himself into it, remembering the feel and the dank smell, remembering the claustrophobic way this place had made him feel, and, just by the way, what had happened to them? How had they fared down in these drains and tunnels? Where exactly had they gone, and how exactly had they gotten out again? He still couldn't remember any of that. All he could think of was Audra.
I am too.
He half-squatted, wincing as the cold water ran into his pants and over his balls and let Eddie off. They stood shin-deep in the water and watched the others descend the ladder. Chapter 21 Under the City 1 It, August 1958
Something new had happened. For the first time in forever, something new.
Before the universe, there had been only two things. One was itself, and the other was the turtle. The turtle was a stupid old thing that never came out of its shell. It thought that maybe the turtle was dead, had been dead for the last billion years or so. Even if it wasn't, it was still a stupid old thing, and even if the turtle had vomited the universe out whole, that didn't change the fact of its stupidity. It had come here long after the turtle withdrew into its shell, here to Earth, and it had discovered a depth of imagination here that was almost new, almost of concern. This quality of imagination made the food very rich. Its teeth rent flesh gone stiff with exotic terrors and voluptuous fears. They dreamed of night beasts and moving muds. Against their will, they contemplated endless gulfs. Upon this rich food, existed in a simple cycle of waking to eat and sleeping to dream. It had created a place in its own image, and it looked upon this place with favor from the dead lights which were its eyes. Derry was its killing pen, the people of Derry its sheep. Things had gone on. Then, these children. Something new. For the first time in forever. When it had burst up into the house on Nebolt Street, meaning to kill them all, vaguely uneasy that it had not been able to do so already, and surely that unease had been the first new thing. Something had happened which was totally unexpected, utterly unthought of. And there had been pain, pain, great roaring pain all through the shape it had taken. And for one moment there had also been fear, because the only thing it had in common with the stupid old turtle and just this. All living things must abide by the laws of the shape they inhabit. For the first time, it realized that perhaps its ability to change its shapes might work against it, as well as for it. There had never been pain before. There had never been fear before. And for a moment, it had thought it might die, Oh, its head had been filled with a great white silver pane, and it had roared and mewled and bellowed, and somehow the children had escaped. But now they were coming. They had entered its domain under the city, 7 foolish children blundering through the darkness without lights or weapons. It would kill them now, surely. It had made a great self-discovery. It did not want change or surprise. It did not want new things, ever. It only wanted to eat and sleep and dream and eat again. Following the pain and that brief, bright fear, another new emotion had arisen, as all genuine emotions were new to it, although it was a great mocker of emotion. Was a great mocker of emotions. Anger. It would kill the children because they had, by some amazing accident, hurt it. But it would make them suffer first, because for one brief moment they had made it fear them. Come to me then, it thought, listening to their approach. Come to me, children, and see how we float down here, how we all float. And yet there was a thought that insinuated itself, no matter how strongly it tried to push the thought away. It was simply this. If all things flowed from it, as they surely had done since the turtle sicked up the universe and then fainted inside its shell, how could any creature of this or any other world fool it or hurt it, no matter how briefly or triflingly? How was that possible? And so, a last new thing had come to it, this not an emotion, but a cold speculation. Suppose it had not been alone, as it had always believed. Suppose there was another. And suppose further that these children were agents of that other. Suppose. It began to tremble. Hate was new. Hurt was new. Being crossed in its purpose was new. But the most terrible new thing was this fear, not fear of the children that had passed, but the fear of not being alone. No, there was no other. Surely there was not. Perhaps because they were children, their imaginations had a certain raw power it had briefly underestimated. But now that they were coming, it would let them come. They would come, and it would cast them one by one into the macroverse, into the deadlights of its eyes. Yes. When they got here, it would cast them, shrieking and insane, into the deadlights. 2. In the tunnels. 2:15 p.m. Bev and Richie had maybe 10 matches between them, but Bill wouldn't let them use them. For the time being, at least, there was still dim light in the drain. Not much, but he could make out the next 4 feet in front of him. And as long as he could keep doing that, they would save the matches. He supposed the little light they were getting must be coming from vents and curbings over their heads, maybe even from the circular vents and manhole covers. It seemed surpassingly strange to think they were under the city, but of course by now they must be. The water was deeper now. 3 times dead animals had floated past. A rat, a kitten, a bloated shiny thing that might have been a woodchuck. He heard one of the others mutter disgustedly as that baby cruised by. The water they were crawling through was relatively placid, but all that was going to come to an end fairly soon. There was a steady hollow roaring not too far up ahead. It grew louder, rising to a one. The water they were crawling through was relatively placid, but all that was going to come to an end fairly soon. There was a steady hollow roaring not too far up ahead. It grew louder, rising to a one-note roar. The drain elbowed to the right. They made the turn, and here were 3 pipes spewing water into their pipe. They were lined up vertically like the lenses on a traffic light. The drain dead-ended here. The light was marginally brighter. Bill looked up and saw they were in a square stone-faced shaft about 15 feet high. There was a sewer grating up there, and water was sloshing down on them in buckets. It was like being in a primitive shower. Bill surveyed the 3 pipes helplessly. The top one was venting water, which was almost clear, although there were leaves and sticks and bits of trash in it. Cigarette butts, chewing gum wrappers, things like that. The middle pipe was venting gray water. and from the lowest one came a grayish-brown flood of lumpy sewage.
Eddie.
Eddie floundered up beside him. His hair was plastered to his head. His cast was a soaking, drippy mess.
Which one?
If you wanted to know how to build something, you asked Ben. If you wanted to know which way to go, you asked Eddie. They didn't talk about this, but they all knew it. If you were in a strange neighborhood and wanted to get back to a place you knew, Eddie could get you there, making lefts and rights with undiminished confidence until you were reduced simply to following him and hoping that things would turn out right, which they always seemed to do. Bill told Richie once that when he and Eddie first began to play in the Barrens, he, Bill, was constantly afraid of getting lost. Eddie had no such fears, and he always brought the two of them out right where he said he was going to.
If I got lost in the Haynesville woods and Eddie was with me, I wouldn't hurry a bit, Bill told Richie. He just knows. My dad says some people hits like they got a humpus in their heads. Eddie's like that.
I can't hear you,
Eddie shouted.
I said, which one?
Which one what?
Eddie had his aspirator clutched in his good hand, and Bill thought he actually looked more like a drowned muskrat than a kid.
Which one do we take?
That all depends on where we want to go, Eddie said. And Bill could have cheerfully throttled him, even though the question made perfect sense. Eddie was looking dubiously at the three pipes. They could fit into all of them, but the Eddie was looking dubiously at the three pipes. They could fit into all of them, but the bottom one looked pretty snug. Bill motioned the others to move up into a circle.
Where the fuck is it?
He asked them.
Middle of town, Richie said promptly. Right under the middle of town, near the canal.
Beverly was nodding. So was Ben. So was Stan.
Mama Mike?
Yes, he said. That's where it is, near the canal, or under it. Bill looked back at Eddie.
Which one?
Eddie pointed reluctantly at the lower pipe, and although Bill's heart sank, he wasn't at all surprised.
That one.
Oh, gross, Stan said unhappily. That's a shit pipe. Mike began and then broke off. He cocked his head in a listening gesture. His eyes were alarmed.
What? Bill began, and Mike put a finger across his lips in a shh gesture.
Now Bill could hear it, too, splashing sounds, approaching, grunts and muffled words. Henry still hadn't given up.
Quick, Ben said, let's go.
Stan looked back the way they had come, then he looked at the lowest of the three pipes. He pressed his lips tightly together and nodded.
Let's go, he said, shit washes off.
Stan the man gets off a good one, Richie cried. Whacka whacka wha.
Richie, will you shut up?
Beverly hissed at him. Bill led them to the pipe, grimacing at the smell, and crawled in. The smell. It was sewage, it was shit, but there was another smell here too, wasn't there? A lower, more vital smell. If an animal's grunt could have a smell, and Bill supposed if the animal in question had been eating the right things, it could. It would be like this undersmell.
We're headed in the right direction, all right. It's been here, and it's been here a lot.
By the time they had gone 20 feet, the air had grown rancid and poisonous. He squished slowly along, moving through stuff that wasn't mud. End of side 26. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.